Hello, this is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service with reports and analysis from across the world. The latest news 7 days a week. BBC World Service podcasts are supported by advertising.
When the cost of living rises, how you invest matters even more. A financial advisor can help you make sense of it all. Now's the time to invest with advice. Visit dynamic.ca/advice to learn more.
Ever wondered what the world's wealthiest people did to get so ridiculously rich?
Our podcast, Good Bad Billionaire, takes one billionaire at a time and explains exactly how they made their money.
And then we decide if they are actually good, bad, or just plain wealthy.
So if you want to know if Rihanna is as much of a bad gal as she claims, or what Jeff Bezos really did to become the first person in history to pocket $100 billion,
listen to Good Bad Billionaire with me, Simon Jack.
And me, Xing Xing. Available now wherever you get your podcasts.
Unexpected Elements is all about finding the surprising science angles to everyday news.
Mind absolutely blown.
Amazing to me.
That's Unexpected Elements from the BBC World Service. Find it wherever you get your BBC podcasts.
This is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service. I'm Gareth Barlow, and in the early hours of Tuesday, the 29th of August, these are our main stories. The pressure on the head of Spanish football to resign for kissing a player after the Women's World Cup final has intensified, with football chiefs from every Spanish region urging him to quit now. Donald Trump has reacted angrily after a judge set the start date for one of his trials for March, a day before the Super Tuesday presidential primaries. And the Nigerian Air Force says it's carried out airstrikes against illegal oil installations in the Niger Delta. Also in the podcast...
The Nisga people believe the memorial pole is alive with the spirit of their ancestors. They say it was stolen from the Nass Valley in British Columbia almost 100 years ago.
So now the 11-metre-high totem pole is beginning its journey home to Canada from a Scottish museum. More on that in a few minutes' time. But first, the Spanish Football Federation's regional presidents have unanimously called for the immediate resignation of the federation boss, Luis Rubiales. In a statement, they said his behaviour had seriously damaged Spanish football when he kissed a player on the lips after the victory in the Women's World Cup. The player, Jenny Hermoso, said it was not consensual. Hundreds of people demonstrated on Monday in the centre of Madrid calling on Mr. Rubiales to go. Speaking to the BBC, a senior member of parliament from the governing Socialist Party in Spain, Hannah Jolol, said that the Spanish people had made their opinions on the issue clear.
The society have judged the president of the Spanish Federation of Football. This country is a feminist country, and these types of attitudes are not tolerated anymore and do not represent the Spanish society. Right now in Madrid, there is a huge demonstration of thousands of people against him and what it represents, you know, that certain abuse of power. Many football players, very famous political voices, many famous personalities around the world and in Spain have complained about his behavior. So yes, I think that there is a big majority of the society that rejects this type of attitudes.
Well, Spanish prosecutors have opened a preliminary investigation looking into whether the act amounted to sexual assault. Oliver Conway got the latest from our correspondent in Madrid, Guy Hedgeko.
I think this is seen as a victory, certainly for those people who have been calling for Mr. Rubiales to resign for the last week or so. That includes the Spanish government. It includes the women's football team who turned against him last week when he claimed that that kiss was consensual and contradicted Jenny Hermoso, who said it wasn't. And many others in Spanish society who've been calling for him to resign. So he hasn't resigned yet, but the feeling is that the fact that his own federation is now calling on him to do so, that's a major development, and it could just be the final nail in the coffin of his leadership of the federation.
Yeah, I mean, it's taken quite a while to get here. At one point, the federation even tried to get itself booted out of UEFA in protest at the intervention of the Spanish government. It still has some work to do to rebuild its reputation, doesn't it?
Well, yes, it does. And this is all rather embarrassing for many members of the Federation, because you go back to Friday of last week, for example, when Mr. Rubiales appeared before the Federation and he said he was not resigning despite the mounting pressure on him. And he insisted that he had done nothing wrong. He said that that kiss had been completely consensual, and he gave a very defiant speech and said that he was staying exactly where he was. Now, when he said all that, a lot of people in that room applauded him. And what we've seen over the last few days is that many of the people who were applauding him then have started to change their tune. Some of them have issued communiques saying that they now actually condemn his behaviour, and that sort of critical mass built over the last few days until we actually got to this stage now, where the whole Federation actually turned against him.
Yeah, interesting to see that turnaround under plenty of criticism from around the country. But the very fact that they did applaud him, what does that say about some in Spanish society?
Well, I mean, we heard today from Yolanda Díaz, who is the Deputy Prime Minister, and she addressed that very issue. Now, she's been someone who's been very vocal on these issues of gender equality and sexual consent during this legislature. And she said, this was disgraceful behaviour to see allies of Mr. Rubiales last week applauding him when, you know, we knew what he had done. We knew that he had kissed Jenny Hermoso, and there was no excuse for anyone to support him. And yet there they were clapping him. She said that, you know, for people to then turn around and start saying that they condemned his behaviour didn't seem right. And she said that all of that kind of behaviour, the behaviour of Mr. Rubiales and all of those who had supported him, was completely intolerable.
And how damaging has this whole affair been for Spanish football? I mean, it's hoping to host the Men's World Cup in 2030 along with Portugal and Morocco.
Yes, and I think that's one of the big worries about all of this. I mean, clearly people were very upset across Spain about this whole affair from the point of view of sexual consent and gender equality and so on. But I think a lot of other people were very angry about it from the point of view of the damage it was doing Spain's reputation internationally. And specifically, there is that concern about the World Cup bid for 2030. I think this was something that was worrying the Federation, members of the Federation, over the last few days, especially when they saw FIFA, football's world governing body, step in and suspend Mr. Rubiales just a few days ago. They suspended him provisionally.
That was Guy Hetchko in Spain. Donald Trump is currently in the midst of preparing for 4 criminal court cases charged with everything from racketeering and violation of the Espionage Act to falsifying business records and defrauding the United States. On Monday, we learned that the former president will go on trial in Washington, D.C. on the 4th of March 2024 to face 4 federal charges. These relate to his alleged attempts to derail the transfer of power to the incoming president, Joe Biden, back in 2020. Team Trump had been pushing for a trial date in 2026, well after the upcoming election. But the judge confirmed the hearing will be just hours before so-called Super Tuesday, a potentially decisive date in the Republican presidential nominating contest. I spoke to our correspondent in Washington, Sean Dilley, and asked him how important the date is of this trial.
It could be significant. And, I have to say the other side to that one is they could just rip it up, because what happens in criminal trials is they start arguing and entering motions. But if it goes ahead as scheduled, then, as you say, the Super Tuesday thing, it is huge. Lots of the huge states, California being among them, they get to vote on who from each party they would like to be the nominee. Essentially, at the end of this, they call it the primaries and the caucuses, where these states get to vote in this way. Between the country, they get to decide which presidential candidate from the Republican Party will face which one from the Democrats. At the moment, it's shaping up to look quite as though it will be a Donald Trump, Joe Biden face off again. But it's a time when he should be out campaigning. He's due to be in court instead. But, you know, we've seen in the past he does tend to use these encounters as political campaigning tools.
Hugely so. We saw millions of dollars raised after that mugshot was taken and spread around the world. And obviously, Sean, there are three other criminal court cases ongoing against Mr. Trump. Are we expecting the one announced for the 4th of March will be the first of these and the rest will follow subsequently?
You can expect anything you like. You can never know. I know enough time of doing this job in journalism that things change quite a lot, but it's certainly the first that we have a date set. We'll run you a little bit through the diary. We'll put to one side the civil cases. At the end of March, he's separately due to go on trial in New York, which is a state case. And he's charged with using his business to hide hush money payments to a porn star, Stormy Daniels. Then in May, he's due to stand trial in Florida over a different... Now, this one's a federal case. This is prosecuted by the US government, very much as in the case we're talking about here today in Washington, D.C. But this case that's prosecuted in Florida relates to classified documents that he's alleged to have held onto and charges that he attempted to hide what he was doing to conceal the retention of those documents. He faces 40 charges in that case. Then, of course, the Georgia case, which everybody will be very aware of because he booked himself into the Fulton County Jail last week. That date for a trial hasn't been set, but we do know that already he's due to have what's called an arraignment, which is a first hearing where people get the opportunity to enter a plea. So that would be happening next week on the 6th of September, should he attend, because in Georgia, unlike other areas, it is possible in some cases to waive that first appearance.
That was Sean Dilley in Washington, and that was the sound of Sean ripping up the rule books. He's both a sound effect artist and a correspondent. Well, for his part, Donald Trump has said he will appeal. He said the judge's setting of the March date amounted to election interference. To Nigeria now, where the Air Force says it's carried out strikes on several illegal oil refining sites in the Niger Delta. It said a boat full of crude oil was also destroyed. The Nigerian authorities have long struggled to prevent the theft of oil from pipelines, but aerial bombardments are rare. With more, here's Will Ross.
Nigeria's Air Force says these are illegal oil refineries that have been hit with airstrikes. The obvious environmental consequences of this tactic were not mentioned. Officials say every day around 400,000 barrels of oil are stolen. That's around a third of Nigeria's daily production. To try to stop the massive theft, successive governments have turned to the militants who once blew up the pipelines and kidnapped oil workers in the Niger Delta. Last year, a company run by a former militant called Tom Polo was given a contract worth tens of millions of dollars to protect the pipelines.
Will Ross. Let's stick in the region, because a month ago, the armed forces in the former French colony of Niger seized power in a military coup. West Africa's regional bloc, ECOWAS, condemned the action and demanded an immediate return to civilian rule, so far without success. But Niger's example isn't unique. Neighbouring Burkina Faso and Mali also saw the army seize power in recent years, justifying their power grab as necessary to tackle the worsening economic and security situations. But have those promises been realised? Our correspondent Priyanka Sippy starts her report in the capital of Burkina Faso, Ouagadougou.
I was here when it started. That day it was not easy for everybody in the city.
Basile, whose name we have changed to protect his identity, is a 24-year-old student from Ouagadougou, Burkina Faso's capital.
There was noise everywhere, gunshots, and it was really very scary and difficult for everybody.
He remembers the day the country experienced its second coup of 2022. The current man in power, Captain Ibrahim Traoré, removed the former interim president over his alleged inability to secure the country. But Basile says that despite promises from this military government, the security situation has worsened, and now he can no longer travel to visit his family village.
I think more than 2 years I have not been able to go there. The terrorists have blocked the roads because you cannot travel without meeting up terrorists.
Almost 15,000 people have died in conflict since 2018. But half of these deaths occurred last year once the military took power. And close to 5 million people need humanitarian assistance. And even more people might be in need soon as prices of basic items continues to go up, leaving many families struggling to put food on the table.
The things that are really getting more expensive are groceries.
So,
Over 800 kilometres away from Ouagadougou, Naba, a musician from Mali's capital, Bamako, is singing a patriotic song. Mali, like Burkina Faso, experienced two military coups in 2020 and 2021.
The situation was getting worse and worse, and we needed a glimmer of hope. We needed someone to really take charge, and that was it. And this coup d'état, did that for us.
Fueled by anti-colonial slogans addressed to French troops, Mali's coup remains popular with citizens. But despite the rhetoric, the UN has said the country is facing a worsening security and a dire humanitarian situation. Despite the warnings, Naba believes that, with time, the military can turn the country around.
Mali today sincerely wants to become independent and autonomous, and we are aware that this is not an easy task.
Now that Niger has also joined Burkina Faso, Mali and Guinea on the list of coup-related sanctions, it remains to be seen how these military governments will face the uphill battle of delivering on their promises.
Reporting there from Priyanka Sippy. Here in the UK, the authorities say they fixed a problem that caused disruption for flights around the world. The glitch affected the planning system at the National Air Traffic Control Network, or NATS or NATS. It caused widespread delays and cancellation. Some passengers were told that their journeys had been postponed by up to 12 hours. Although British airspace did remain open, officials limited the number of planes that could either take off or land. And many airlines have warned it will take time to clear the backlog. Our correspondent Joe Inwood followed developments.
It's been a day of delay and disruption. Just after midday, the National Air Traffic Service announced it was suffering from a technical issue. It came as hundreds of reports started to emerge from passengers stuck at airports across the UK and Europe. One of them was Chris Rowe. He was supposed to be returning to the UK from Rotterdam with his wife and baby.
Our flight was due to take off about half an hour ago. It just says delayed at the moment, but on the app it's saying departure at 2 a.m. tomorrow. With a one-year-old, obviously we've got nappies and wet wipes and things and food to worry about.
At 2:20, it emerged the problem was with the automated flight planning system. Routes were having to be input manually, causing massive delays both in the UK and around Europe. Michelle Robson, who spent years working at air traffic control and was delayed flying to London from Jersey, had already been told of the cause.
As I understand it, from Eurocontrol and speaking to former colleagues, there was a flight planning system failure this morning which affected both centres in the UK. It's unusual for it to last this long. There are failures every couple of years, but normally they only last a couple of hours, so it's quite an extensive failure if it's affecting both centres in the UK.
Just before 3 p.m, the aviation data firm Cirium revealed 232 departing and 271 inbound flights had already been cancelled. About 20 minutes after that, NATS put out a statement saying the problem had been fixed. It apologised for the disruption. According to John Strickland, an industry expert, that disruption will not end anytime soon.
This is going to ripple on for the rest of the day and indeed into the following days, because aircraft that have been held on the ground with crews face the situation of the ticking clock in terms of the hours that crews can stay on duty, and that then causes a further effect on not having either planes or crews in the right place or with hours available to operate following services.
Coming on a bank holiday in the middle of summer, there could hardly have been a worse time for this to happen. Hundreds of thousands of journeys disrupted at huge cost to the airlines and the passengers who rely on them.
The BBC's Joe Inwood. A large totem pole is being returned to Canada nearly a century after it was sold to the National Museum of Scotland. Researchers say the pole, which is 11 metres tall, was stolen from the Nisga Nation, an indigenous group in British Columbia. Ahead of the pole's return, a ceremony was held at the museum in Edinburgh, as Katie Hunter reports.
A slow procession through the National Museum of Scotland, ahead of a private spiritual ceremony. People from the Nisga Nation are in Edinburgh to prepare their totem pole for the journey home. Among them, Nisga chief Simog Nishtaw.
Today was
probably one of the most happy days in my life, because I'm really, really emotional right now. And I could feel my ancestral grandmother.
The Nisga people believe the memorial pole is alive with the spirit of their ancestors. They say it was stolen from the Nass Valley in British Columbia almost 100 years ago. Dr. John Giblin is from National Museums Scotland.
I'm really pleased that the pole will be returning to its home, where its spiritual, cultural and historical significance is most keenly felt. And I'm really pleased that we've been able to use our procedure to work with the family to be able to help make this happen.
Next month, the memorial pole will leave the museum in the middle of the night before it's flown back to British Columbia by the Canadian military. Nisga academic Dr. Amy Parent, also called Knox Jowett, says it'll be a special moment.
I don't think I can ever be fully prepared for the emotions that you feel on a day that is so historically significant to us, but I can imagine that I'm going to feel absolutely just joy in my heart and a sense of peace in knowing that we have our ancestral relative home with us back on our motherlands.
The Nisga Nation say this is a historic moment of reconciliation. They hope the world is watching.
Katie Hunter reporting from Scotland. Still to come.
There's a slalom track of obstacles, an S-shaped sort of bend, and a series of tight curves. Then they got drivers to do those tracks sober.
But what did the police in Japan do next in their efforts to tackle the problems of drink driving?
Ever wondered what the world's wealthiest people did to get so ridiculously rich?
Our podcast, Good Bad Billionaire, takes one billionaire at a time and explains exactly how they made their money.
And then we decide if they are actually good, bad, or just plain wealthy.
So if you want to know if Rihanna is as much of a bad gal as she claims, or what Jeff Bezos really did to become the first person in history to pocket $100 billion,
listen to Good Bad Billionaire with me, Simon Jack.
And me, Xing Xing. Available now wherever you get your podcasts.
The road to success seems quick.
My first try to go to the Olympic Games was in 1980.
Everybody's been seeing me run for years growing up.
Get to know the people behind the medals as Olympians and Paralympians share their stories.
My story can help so many other victims and survivors.
On the Podium from the BBC World Service.
The journey and the ups and downs.
Listen now by searching for On the Podium wherever you get your BBC podcasts.
Right now, though, it's the Global News Podcast, and we take you to Afghanistan next, where a group of young female students have been stopped at the airport and turned away while trying to leave the country to study abroad. Some of the group have been granted scholarships to the University of Dubai by an Emirati billionaire. That was after the Taliban banned women from attending university. Our correspondent Yelda Hakim told me more.
These scholarships really provided a window of hope, a window of opportunity when so much else is bleak across the country. As we've been reporting over the last 2 years, it's been almost 707 days now since Afghan girls over the age of 12 can't go to school. And then in December last year, they were banned from going to university. That's when the University of Dubai, like so many other universities around the world, stepped in and said, look, we'll provide these girls with scholarships. We'll give them the education they're denied in their home country. They got as far as the airport, and then they were banned and blocked from leaving.
We know that some secondary education for girls is going on in secret in Afghanistan. We also know of this case with these girls being stopped from going to Dubai. Do we think there therefore may be more cases like this?
I think throughout the last 2 years, we haven't necessarily heard publicly about cases of women being prevented and turned away, but it has happened. It just so happened that this particular individual, a billionaire businessman who had provided these scholarships to these young girls and young women, was very vocal on social media and said, I'm not happy. These young women have been blocked and prevented. In fact, three young women who were traveling with a male chaperone who had made it as far as the aircraft itself were escorted off. He made it very clear he was unhappy, and it's turned into a global story. But we have absolutely, those of us who are Afghan watchers and followers, know of other cases over the last year and a half where Afghan women have been prevented from getting on aircraft.
It's been an interesting couple of days because a couple of days ago we see a founder of the Taliban say that many Afghans don't support, and many in the Taliban don't support this ban on young women and girls getting an education or this partial ban of women in the workplace. The Taliban then followed that up a day later by banning women from going to a national park. Now these young girls can't go to Dubai. It seems as though there is an element of discord within the Taliban. Where do you see that going? How do you see that developing?
We've known about this discord for a while now. There are frictions within. There is a sort of there's a tug of war for power between the Taliban in Kabul versus the Taliban in Kandahar. Now, we are told by the Taliban in Kabul that those in Kandahar are the hardliners. They're the ones calling the shots. They're the ones imposing the ban. And there is concern that if anyone sort of tries to defy, any Taliban leaders that try and defy this, other than making public statements, it could lead to an internal sort of civil war almost, if you will. And that is what a lot of Afghans are concerned about. They've had 40 years of conflict and war. So there is this feeling that we'll sort of see how this plays out before anyone makes any sorts of moves. But I have never seen the situation in the country this bleak, this hopeless. I was there in February of this year. And as you say, I often speak to Afghan women and girls about their situation. And there is a feeling of desperation because this is the generation that tasted freedom and that freedom has been taken away from them.
Insight and analysis there from Yalda Hakim. Two separate studies have concluded that ultra-processed food significantly increases the risk of high blood pressure, heart attacks and strokes. The findings were presented at a conference in Amsterdam. In the UK, ultra-processed food makes up on average about 55% of people's diets. Our health correspondent Dominic Hughes reports.
Ultra-processed foods are products that have been substantially altered through industrial methods such as hydrogenation and moulding, and may contain additives like dyes, stabilisers, flavour enhancers and emulsifiers. They're often high in sugar, salt and fats, but they're also relatively cheap and plentiful, including items as diverse as cereals and mass-produced bread to fizzy drinks and fast food. Now, a study in China has found those who ate the most ultra-processed products were nearly 25% more likely to suffer from a heart attack, stroke or angina. In a separate study in Sydney, scientists found that in a group of 10,000 middle-aged women, those with the highest proportion of ultra-processed food in their diets were 39% more likely to develop high blood pressure when compared with those with the lowest intake. Anushriya Pant, the University of Sydney, one of the report's authors, says many people are unaware that foods they assume are healthy, wraps or soups or low-fat yogurts, are in fact ultra-processed.
The nutrient profile of ultra-processed foods is inherently not very good for our heart health. Ultra-processed food is high in sodium, added sugars, low in fibre. This has led to a diet that is low in fresh, minimally processed foods like fruit, vegetables and whole grains. And we all know that eating these leads to better cardiovascular profile.
The problem for the UK is that ultra-processed foods make up more than half the average British diet. And the levels are higher among the young and the poor. Georgina Perry runs a food charity in the Hartcliffe area of Bristol. She says that while fresh food is healthier, it's also more expensive. And in the middle of a cost of living crisis, that becomes the decisive factor.
Families don't want to take a risk. They don't want to spend money on fresh fruit and vegetables that perhaps the children or members of the family won't eat. And what is available and what is a known quantity, because people will eat it because their palates have become accustomed to it, ultra-processed foods.
Experts say that much more research is needed into what impact these ultra-processed foods are having on our health, particularly as this research suggests it's not just the high sugar, salt and fat content that could be harming us, but something more intrinsic to the way these products are manufactured.
That report there by Dominic Hughes. Next to Lebanon. The country's in the midst of a huge economic crisis, inflation in triple figures, a banking system that's collapsed. The currency there, the Lebanese pound, or lira in Arabic, is in freefall. But wine industry is bucking the trend. Wine is booming. Hannah McCarthy reports.
I'm at a wine fair in Beirut. Lebanon currently produces over 7.5 million bottles of wine every year. And for decades, it has been one of the country's few successful exports. Even now, while Lebanon is going through a severe financial crisis, new wineries have been continuing to open.
3 years ago, we just started experimenting with different types of grapes and varieties. But last year, we actually said, that's it, let's do our own wine. So this year, we're releasing our first two wines under Hia. Hia means she in Arabic.
Despite the interest in Lebanese wine, power cuts and the banking crisis have created major obstacles for people like Michelle Shami, who are launching their new wines.
You go to work on something and then there's no electricity. Just trying to get money out of the bank is difficult. Just so many struggles that I guess is just native to here and that people don't understand unless they've actually been here. So yeah, these are the tough things about living here and making wine here.
Gaston Hochar's family has been making wine in Lebanon for three generations. Chateau Mazar is bottled on a mountain overlooking the town of Ghazir and today can be found in stores around the world.
Today we ship worldwide all the wines except the Corail, but they all exist a little bit everywhere. We're not concentrating on specific markets. Market goes down, you have others which compensate.
Gaston knows all about the challenges of making and exporting wine from Lebanon.
Today you have nearly 60 producers in Lebanon. It's not an easy market. It's not at all easy to export. This year is challenging because you have a lot of things happening all over the world between inflation and Ukraine, Russian war. But we have a certain resiliency.
The one thing Gaston isn't worried about is demand for Lebanese wine.
People who are knowledgeable in wine realize that these tastes are not often found all over the world. And so therefore, if they want these characters, then they have to buy Mazar. And therefore, the demand is there, and I'm not afraid it's going to disappear.
Amidst all the economic gloom in Lebanon, Lebanese wine looks set to remain one of the few bright lights for the country for some time to come.
From Lebanon, that was Hannah McCarthy. Let's stick with alcohol, because Japan has some of the strictest laws around drink driving. But now, a new study there is taking a somewhat unorthodox approach to preventing it by encouraging drivers to consume alcohol. Stephanie Prentice told me more.
This is a joint initiative between the police there and driving instructors, and they're trying to tackle what they call overconfidence when it comes to driving under the influence. So they set up three sections of road. There's a slalom track of obstacles, an S-shaped sort of bend, and a series of tight curves. Then they got drivers to do those tracks sober. After that, they gave the drivers a mix of beer, plum wine, and this Japanese spirit called shochu to get the blood alcohol levels up to twice the legal threshold for driving, then sent them back off around those courses.
Well, the obstacles, the S-bend, the tight curves, the beer, plum wine and the spirit resulted in what results?
Well, unsurprisingly, this is where it got interesting because the drivers said they felt like they were able to drive, something police say that people caught drink driving often say. The results told a different story. So one person who set off with a passenger, she thought she completed the bollards on the slalom really well, then was told she'd been repeatedly accelerating and braking so hard that her passenger was being lurched around. She'd veered into the wrong lane. She headed into the S-bend at such a high speed that the team stopped her from taking it on. Those results were pretty standard across the board. Therein, said the researchers, lies the major point. Drivers think they're okay to drive. They might even avoid any noticeable incidents. But the skills we all know that are needed to drive, like cognitive capacity, judgment, and dare I say, motor skills, those are impaired. But the driver thinks they're driving safely. So the team are asking other drivers and journalists to come in, give the course a go after some plum wine themselves. And that's all to try and raise awareness of the dangers of that overconfidence behind the wheel.
Our very own plum wine drinker, Stephanie Prentice, there reminding us all not to drink and drive. Now, the much-anticipated opening of a recently discovered time capsule at the US Military Academy at West Point has revealed something rather unexpected. A hushed audience of cadets and officials had gathered amid some considerable excitement at the famed institution in New York to see what secrets the small grey lead box had been concealing for nigh on 200 years. Mira Davis lifts the lid on what happens next.
The time capsule, as it had been dubbed, was discovered during the recent refurbishment of a statue to the Revolutionary War hero Tadeusz Kosciuszko. Most intriguingly, it's thought the box had lain undisturbed for 194 years, a period covering much of the history of the modern United States after the Declaration of Independence in 1776. Initial X-ray images had failed to reveal anything conclusive because of the density of the lead, but it did suggest there was an unidentifiable mass within. As two West Point officials carefully prized open the lid, a live camera zoomed in to reveal absolutely nothing. As crestfallen dignitaries and cadets tried to contain their disappointment, perhaps the ghosts of West Point students from almost two centuries ago were enjoying having played the ultimate practical joke on their successors.
You can see a video of that unveiling on our website, bbc.com/news. That was Wira Davis. And that's all from us for now, but there will be a new edition of the Global News podcast a little later. If you want to comment on this one or any of the topics, do send us an email. The address is globalpodcast@bbc.co.uk. You can also find us on X, formerly known as Twitter, @GlobalNewsPod. This edition was mixed by Javi Galani. The producer was Liam McSheffrey. The editor, Karen Martin. I'm Gareth Barlow. And until next time, goodbye.
Make back to school stress-free with DoorDash. Get all your school essentials delivered right to your door with 30% off when you spend $25 or more from select stores. Dash that binder, notebook, pizza, and more with DoorDash. Terms and conditions apply.
When the cost of living rises, how you invest matters even more. A financial advisor can help you make sense of it all. Now's the time to invest with advice. Visit dynamic.ca/advice to learn more.